Blog Talk Radio.
Routinely fail to wash their hands before touching patients.
As Natural News reported in January 2010, a whopping 247 people die every day in U.S. hospitals from medical staff failing to wash their hands. This is like a jumbo jet falling out of the sky and killing everyone on board every single day. It's like a 9/11 terrorist attack happening every 2 weeks. This is one of the most alarming and preventable causes of death in America today, and virtually no one even talks about it. Doctors, of course, strongly contribute to the development of superbugs by handing out antibiotics as if they were Halloween candy. Someone shows up at their office with a sniffle, and the busy doctor scribbles out a prescription for some fashionable new antibiotic that earns some perks from the young drug rep whose PC database tracks every name brand prescription he writes. The patient, meanwhile, spends a pocket fortune on a useless drug that's actually quite dangerous. Not only does it increase the patient's chances of developing a mutant strain of drug-resistant bacteria, it also flushes antibiotics down the drain and contaminates the environment downstream. So if you're walking around in a public, suspiciously glancing around to see who might be sniffing or sneezing, clear your head and think about the reality for a second. The CDC wants you to stupidly believe all the unvaccinated people are a threat to your health, when in reality, people who consciously refuse vaccines tend to be far healthier and get sick far less often than the hypochondriac dweebs who rush out to get vaccinated every few months.
Doctors and drugs are the greatest threat to your health, far greater than terrorism. The real people who are a threat to your health are not just the pill-popping antibiotic consumers, but also the psyched-out grandma of psychotropic drugs barreling down the road behind the wheel of a 1978 Buick, driving while medicated. The teen schoolboy who was diagnosed with depression and put on SSRI drugs that make him feel violently suicidal. Or the pedestrian who wants to inject your child with chemotherapy to prevent cancer and insist he's going to call CPS if you don't let him poison your child. The drug addict pharmacist between incorrectly filling your prescription with random deadly chemicals, snorts up his own private concoction of controlled substances in the back room. The oncologist who misdiagnosed you with breast cancer but wants to poison you with 5 rounds of chemotherapy just to be sure. Oh, yeah, I bet he never told you that he profits from selling you the chemotherapy drugs that poison you. I'm a school bus driver with a heart condition who takes an extra dose of deadly statin drugs and suffers a fatal heart attack, heart muscle breakdown, while behind the wheel of a bus carrying 58 school children toward railroad crossing. These are the real threats to your safety, not a bunch of healthy people who deliberately refuse to be injected with hazardous vaccines. But, of course, the medical establishment doesn't want you to be aware of any risks associated with using their products. All their drugs are perfectly safe, perfectly effective, perfectly priced, perfectly profitable. There's nothing wrong with them, by God, or the FDA would never have approved them, would they? So that's the... That's what happens. So it's not those people with the vaccines that are public unvaccinated.
No, the ones that are not vaccinated are not the problem.
Right. It's the people who take antibiotics and...
to excess.
Right.
They're really the scary ones.
Yeah. But anyway, this one I found interesting because Anonymous attacked Monsanto. All right? Hacked into Monsanto's.
Engages in social justice hinting of Monsanto, hacking of Monsanto.
Yeah. A hacker community has risen to the challenge of targeting the most evil corporation in the world, a corporation responsible for the attempted overthrow of global agriculture. That firm, of course, is Monsanto, which was voted the most evil corporation in the world by Natural News readers in January 2001.
Antisec, which is reportedly affiliated with Anonymous, hacked into Monsanto's service, a quiet and outdated database of user comments and emails, then dumped it on the web. while the inquired material was not in itself meaningful and it didn't reveal any smoking guns. The real news here is that Antisec has turned its attention on Monsanto and recognizes how incredibly evil that corporation really is. Hackers have more ethics than government operatives.
What happened, what's apparent in all this is that the Antisec hacker group has ethics. Yes, you heard that right. This group has ethics in the sense that they pick targets who are damaging life on our planet and driving countless farmers out of business, rather than merely picking targets for their own gain.
Hacking in and of itself, you see, is neither good nor bad. Technology is morally neutral until someone decides to use it for something. From that point, it is the morals and ethics of the user, or group of users, who determines the ethical implications from its use. Government uses technology to secretly surveil all your emails, for example. That's evil. The military-industrial complex uses technology to fire depleted uranium shells at civilian buildings and structures in Afghanistan. That's evil, too. It's also a violation of the UN conventions, but that's another story. So what do? You call the use of technology to destroy evil? Well, that's good. Any use of technology to disrupt the operations of an evil institution or to halt the expansion of an institution that is causing widespread death and destruction is by definition good.
Monsanto is targeted for crimes against humanity. You can't find a more evil example of a corporation than Monsanto, in my opinion.
Yeah.
This company sues farmers whose fields have been contaminated by Monsanto GM seeds. It fights against the full transparency labeling of GMOs in order to keep consumers in the dark. It conspires with the USDA behind closed doors to legalize experimental GM crops. It unleashes untold destruction on the global environment through genetic population. And it has been involved with everything from Agent Orange to aspartame. This is a company with a reputation of death, destruction, and irreversible global damage. Your continued attack on the world's food supply,
as well as the health of those who eat it, has earned you our full attention, Antisec wrote about the firm. Your crimes against humanity are too many to name on one page. That's true. Even Natural News can't keep up with all the crimes of Monsanto. You have put over 9,000 small-time farmers out of business by using your enormous legal team to bury them with your malicious patent lawsuits, Antisec wrote in its statement. You have continually introduced harmful, even deadly products into our food supply without warning, without care, all for your own profit.
And you can see the full statement if you go to pastehtml.com/view/bpvygosbp.html.
The best thing is to
I know that, but, you know, you break me up right in the middle so nobody can figure it out. You know
well, they need to go to this article.
Yeah,
and
go to naturalnews.com and check it out. But edible vaccines and more. The data dump acquired by Antisec, or Anonymous, reveals that what appears to be user-posted comments on an article posted by Monsanto, some of these comments involve edible vaccines, and they appear to have once been fully public comments. In one comment with the subject edible HIV vaccine based on scrub typhus, a Cornell AG graduate student named Henry Brown drools over the possibility of feeding the world HIV vaccines by engineering their local food crops to contain the vaccine. He gives a contact at Cornell who specializes in plant vaccines, and he goes on to brag about his own gene mapping thesis, and so on and so forth. In another comment, someone named Michael Katz talks about how Monsanto needs to indoctrinate children with pro-GMO attitudes by influencing the schools. All the typos are his, but, by the way, not mine. And it's amazing to me that so many apparently this is what he said, apparently intelligent people, including those friends of mine, harbor superstitious views of biotech and genetically altered foods and plants. They fail to understand that water and arable lands supplies are finite and that world population is not. I would also forward these articles to high schoolers and their teachers. The argument for biotech is going to be a long one, and we must include bright youngsters and their teachers in our fight. So anyway, it goes on, but the different things that they did. But it's kind of, I find it interesting. Ethical hacking targets
destructive
institutions. Yeah. Personally, I enjoy seeing the hacker community go after the bad guys like Monsanto. Government regulators won't hold these groups accountable, and the mainstream sellout media won't ask the tough questions. Who is supposed to keep these institutions honest? And there's a great sense of social justice in seeing this take place.
This is from Natural News.
Yeah. Revolution may be brewing. It is a well-known fact of history that people will only remain oppressed for a short while, and after which they will take matters into their own hands. This targeting of Monsanto by anti-sec is just one sign of many more to come. Signs that people are tired of being poisoned, lied to, exploited, and fed an endless stream of corporate BS and government lies. Personally, I think anti-sec is just the beginning of Monsanto's troubles. I had a weird dream just the other night involving thousands of farmers across the country physically marching on Monsanto's headquarters, conducting citizens' arrests of all Monsanto employees, and torching the entire complex and watching it burn it to the ground. I didn't know what to make of it. Was this a vision of things to come, or just my subconscious mind playing out its own creative vision of social justice? My position has always been to avoid violence, of course, so I hope that if such an event does occur, nobody gets hurt. And what I do know is that Monsanto is engaged in the ultimate violence against humankind, the kind of violence that is insidious because it happens invisibly at the microscopic level, yet it wrecks health and destruction everywhere, and not just in farmers' suicides across India, but also in the frustration and despair that inevitably follow a farmer's decision to plant GM seeds, spray his field with Roundup. Little does he know that he's destroying his own future, poisoning the land for at least a generation. So, and the article goes on. Funding the revolution against genetically engineered poison. Go to this site, responsibletechnology.org/blog/1853. Maybe get something there. So, anyway, let's go on. This one troubled me as well, but kind of the official policy of Israel to...
This is from ukrnet.info.
Yep.
This is Palestinian Oppression, Official Israeli Policy by Stephen Lendman. Born in blood, Israel's been drenched in it since. Its agenda reflects racist state terror ruthlessness. Can you hear the sound of injustice? Asked Palestinian Solidarity Campaign Alexei Sale, saying, to me, the behavior of Israel and the uncritical support it gets from Western governments is like a destructive force harming bodily organs. Its sound resonates 24 hours a day and poisons the whole world with its malignance. Palestinians bear the burden, besieged Gazans and thousands of political prisoners, most of all, more below. Let's make 2012 the year that injustice ends, said Sale. The world can't wait, nor should it. Injustice to anyone harms everyone. For Palestinians, it's a way of life. Daily oppression terrorizes them. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights published weekly reports documenting it. In the latest, March 1st, one said dozens of Israeli security forces attempted to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque in Jerusalem while Palestinian worshippers were inside praying. Systematic terror attacks occur regularly. They include bombing and shelling Gaza, killing civilians, middle-of-the-night neighborhood incursions, attacking peaceful protesters, and daily arrests. Thousands of political prisoners reflect them. Many resist heroically. Hunger striking is the weapon of their choice. Kader Adnan preferred death to unjust detention. Hannah Shablout Shalabi joined his struggle for justice. On March 4th, the Adamir Prisoner Support and Human Rights Association tweeted, "Hannah Shalabi enters day 18 of hunger strike as military judge prepares meeting to decide on confirming her administration detention." On March 2nd, she expressed determination to refuse food to highlight Israeli injustice against all Palestinian prisoners, especially those held uncharged under administrative detention.
On March 1st, Palestinian prisoner society lawyer Fawaz Ash-Shalavi visited her. She explained her horrific ordeal, including extreme prison harshness to break her spirit and force her to ingest food. She refuses. She is determined to persist. She wants her message delivered and heard. Her health's deteriorating as a result, and justice taking precedence. On March 3rd, she extended greetings ahead of International Women's Day. On March 8th, it's commemorated annually. Observed for over a century, global gender equality and peace advocacy rallies are held. They also stress ending violence and injustice against women and girls everywhere. Shalabi told Palestinian Prisoner Society lawyer Shireen Araki, she's hungry. She's hunger striking against Palestinian injustice and for all struggling women everywhere. She won't compromise her rights or dignity. She'll persist until freed, adding Israel has gone too far in humiliating and enslaving Palestinians, in addition to practicing various types of insults and torture. Released in last year's Shalat prison swap, she said, rearresting her reflects revenge and Israel's racist policy that knows no mercy. She calls allegations against her fabrications. She also saluted Palestinian women ahead of International Women's Day, saying, they'll always be the spearhead of resistance against the occupiers. She's right.
Mm.
And despite this article is extremely long. I'm sorry, I didn't want to.
Yeah, it's a little bit too long.
So anyway, she's saying that.
What's the last paragraph? Say maybe there's a summation.
Yeah. International. That gives us the right to peaceful protest and so on and so forth. It goes on, and it's pretty much the same. But I just wanted to say that give note to the lady who's.
Protesting,
and to those people who are enduring the ongoing assault by the Israelis in Gaza and then in Palestine. So, at least we get the word out somewhere. There was a brief, let's see, we've got about...
do you have a little audio piece?
Yeah, there was one here I wanted to play. I thought it was interesting. We could read this instead because if we may not have time tonight, but this is very important.
There isn't much on the second page. Most of it's on the first page, but go to the second. Go to the whole article.
Well,
if you go to the whole article, then we can read it consistently.
Okay.
Sometimes those words are taken from the middle or...
Okay, the great Stalinist purge of media critics.
And this is from Prison Planet.
Right, on Obama's reported enemies list. Is the reported 2009 Obama enemies list a roadmap for a great purging of critics in the lead up to the 2012 elections?
With
the sudden death of Andrew Breitbart immediately prior his plans to release footage damning of Obama, the recent firing of Judge Napolitano and Patrick Buchanan and the IRS harassment of the anti-war critic Cindy Sheehan, notably alone in her left-leaning protest of Obama in the post-Bush era, we have the suggestion of a great purging of critics in the lead-up to the 2012 election. Breitbart, in particular, was reportedly meeting with Sheriff Joel Arpaio and others in his final days, signaling a possible resurgence of challenges to Obama's eligibility and reelectability. Meanwhile, an admitted secret media war has been taking place against the Ron Paul campaign. Right, wrong, or in between, several prominent critics of the President Obama or of the controlled stage elections and left-right paradigm in general, have been targeted in recent months or alternately fallen on bad luck. With respect to the fact that the full picture is still obscured, something is brewing here. Breitbart, flashback is Obama's enemy list.
Yeah.
Breitbart, Napolitano, Buchanan, and Sheehan were on the list reportedly by the Globe in September 2009, released well within Obama's first year in office, but at least one of those who've come under fire lately were listed in the reported enemies list tied to Obama's White House, among those are Glenn Beck, Rupert Murdoch, and the country music legend Hank Williams Jr. Whatever their own issues, baggage, or integrity in reporting, all have been targeted in a larger suppression of free speech. While most of those on this list are typical neocon right-wing critics, some like Jesse Jackson were anything but. Others like Larry Sinclair were leveling allegations at the time but have since failed to gain significant traction or larger media attention. And Larry Sinclair, of course, was the guy who accused him of murder, Obama of murder,
uh-huh,
and cocaine dealing and everything else. What does the list, which also included Alex Jones shortly after the release of his film The Obama Deception, prove accurate in highlighting the vindictiveness and methodical targeting of the Obama teams or its allies? Does it paint a picture of media targets yet to come as the 2012 vote approaches? And let's see. They list the number of people that are, they list 25 of them on his list. That's about it. So I got about 3 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, I don't know if we'll get a chance to play this, but I'll play some of it. I missed it. There was a short piece on Obama's birth certificate that came up, and it showed that it was proven to be false. The one that he supplied, if I can find it. It's been taken off.
That could
so,
be. Yeah. Sometimes that happens.
Yeah, he gets deleted.
Mm-hmm.
Because either they
decide they don't want you to read it or they have pressure to take it down.
You just
don't know.
Yeah.
You never really find out what the truth is on that.
Nope.
You can only hazard a guess, that's all.
Yeah. I don't know why. It was here just a while. You saw it, right?
Which one was that?
The one on Obama's.
There was a couple on there.
Yeah, but it was on his. That's all right. Yeah, it doesn't matter. We have to go to our guest here now. And I'm going to give Hillary a call. And you can introduce him.
Okay. We have our guest coming up is Larry Duerman, Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Union Council 4 out of New Britain, Connecticut. And he talks to us about once a month on things that are going on with the union or nationally. And sometimes internationally he has a call. comments on what's happening in the political world. Let's see if we can get him.
Hello.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Good. What's going on?
Oh, not much. How are you, Larry? I bet you've been busy.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah?
A little bit.
I just read an interesting fact off your newsletter that was kind of troubling.
What's that?
It was on what was happening in Southern California in the warehouses. A warehouse.
With Walmart, yeah.
I mean, how much is enough for these people?
Well, apparently not enough.
All they have is enough.
That's the answer. That's the answer. It's, this is the economy we're living in. And it's pretty frightening, actually.
Who don't know, what they've done is they really subcontract out these warehouses. So there's like a wall between Walmart and the subcontractor, so you never really
exactly.
get out Walmart. But
exactly.
One of their workers, Jorge Soto, who became like a supervisor, was forced to falsify workers' time cards. So they were paid less than minimum wage. And, of course, if he didn't do it, he'd been fired, and so would the workers.
Yep, and this is, if you kind of took out the locations, you would say that this is, you know, what happens in China with Apple or, you know, some other large corporation that's taking advantage of people overseas. But, you know, it's happening right here.
It's hard to believe that it's happening right in Southern California, and it's been very difficult because of the fear that's been created for these people to form a union.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's ultimately, you know, what it's about. And, you know, it's the third world right here in the so-called first world.
Yes.
In my estimation, at least, you know.
Absolutely. I think that's a good way to describe it.
Did you happen to see the news report, I think CBS did it or someone, on the place in China where the people were committing suicide, where the workers were committing suicide.
Right. These were the app. They were working for the contractor under Apple.
Yeah, that's correct.
Was it Apple? I couldn't remember. But what happened was that all around the building, they had suicide nets
mm-hmm.
Put up.
Yeah, it's creepy.
Isn't
yeah.
that horrible?
And yeah.
They wouldn't change the working conditions, so they put up nets.
They just put
mm-hmm.
up nets, you know. And
there's something really tragically symbolic about that. It's like ghoulishly fitting for the world in which we live.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's really something. And I think
the problem there, I mean, they won't even let these guys kill themselves. You know what I mean?
That's what I'm saying.
their work and life is so horrible, you know, that and they can't get out of it, and they can't even die, you know.
Yep. I like I said, if there was ever a worse symbol of what's going on in this global economy, that's it. You know, that's absolutely it.
And the other thing that's really bothered me lately, of course, is Rush Limbaugh's latest statements about the woman who supported contraception, the university student. But the thing that really irritated me was that it wasn't just against her, it's against women in general.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't understand why he's not being charged with a hate crime. I mean, that's what it is. It's hate against women, and why aren't people up in arms about it? I mean, some guy who in Connecticut who made a racial slur, he's been charged with a hate crime.
Right. One thing I do want to point out, though, and not to say that this is good, because this whole thing is really offensive on so many levels, but the fact that advertisers, sponsors are beating the retreat from his show is finally, you know, something welcome after all these years of kind of radio tyranny and stirring people into a froth. And as you say, I mean, I do think he is a practitioner of radio hate crime and radio hatred. So,
but What I misdid with his comments wasn't even as bad.
Right.
It was pretty despicable.
It was bad. But the only reason it got taken him off the air, not only was he going after women,
but it was racial too.
But it was racial.
It was
as well.
Both. Racial and women.
And Imus got canned because of that. But Imus didn't have as big a following, even though he had a large following on MSNBC and all that. But he,
and Rush Limbaugh.
But not as big as Limbaugh. And also, his employers were of a liberal-minded group, supposedly.
And he's liberal. And he wasn't the hack that Limbaugh is for the.
He was pretty bad, but I mean, Imus was pretty bad, but nobody's heard from him since, you know. And that would be just a wonderful day for the radio industry if Limbaugh got the axe too, you know.
Oh, and the thing that I find interesting is that he's on Clear Channel, which of course is owned by Bain Capital. Is that correct?
Yeah, which is why Romney hasn't really
said anything about it.
You know, when he was asked about it, he says, "Well, I wouldn't have chosen those words." You know, that's all he said.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a frighteningly incestuous relationship, you know, between the media and the politicians and the, you know, and what's
radio
happening.
People.
Yeah, and radio,
yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Just as it's a frightening and incestuous relationship between politicians and the corporations that have brought us to our feet.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's Goldman Sachs or AIG. These incestuous relationships are destroying this country, quite frankly. But, you know, since you're focusing on Limbaugh, I wholeheartedly agree. And, again, it is absolutely stunning to see the lack of courage in denouncing what he did. And I think it does speaks volumes to the lack of courage in the Republican Party, at least.
I'm just waiting to see if these women's groups or the ACLU or somebody files a massive lawsuit against this guy, you know?
I hope that happens.
Yeah, I do.
Why aren't they? You know, where?
Because I think, you know, Lila's absolutely on target. They are spreading hatred, and, you know, you think about how the Morris D's and the Anti-Defamation League put the Klan out of business down south. With lawsuits, and you know, maybe it's time to try that angle.
Well,
I mean,
yeah.
lesser people than he have been charged with hate crimes,
sure,
for the same sort of stuff,
mm-hmm.
And he is so public.
Well,
what he says
guy, yeah.
is so damaging to
well,
women, I think.
That Clown Savage too.
That guy.
There's no limit to what that guy has said, and yet he's still on the air with Clear Channel. So it's like.
I agree.
Right.
It is hate radio, and I certainly don't advocate
and
censorship, but something's got to be done here.
I think
so. You still got slander and libel laws, you know what I mean, in
mm-hmm.
this country as well, you know. And
Well, we used to.
We used to.
They
used to enforce that.
I mean, I've said enough stuff against George Bush and Rick Sanitarium and everybody else.
Rick Sanitarium.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like these guys are out there, you know what I mean? And they're giving back as much as they're getting. So, you know, they're just infuriating everybody. But, I mean, this girl, what did she do? She was in there, you know?
Just doing what you're supposed to do in this country, which is stand up, speak out,
yeah.
Fight for your rights, and live by the law. And these folks don't.
Yeah,
do that.
Now the unions got attacked for standing up in Wisconsin and Ohio and all these other places.
Yeah,
you
there's
know?
A creeping fascism in this country, and maybe it's not creeping anymore. It's
growing
like wildfire.
Yeah, it's out there.
Yeah, the steamroller.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
So I actually think this. I think Fluke is a. To me, she's a heroine, and you know, at least. We're seeing some of the advertisers pull back, so there are some positive sides to what certainly, you know, is another ugly chapter in the, you know, annals of hate radio and hate media.
terrible.
Well, there are some big ones. There were some big advertisers there. There was AOL and a couple of insurance companies.
Of course, you know, I question those companies for advertising in the first place. What does that tell you about them, that they are so soulless that in order to turn a buck, they'll advertise on hate radio? I mean, I understand that obviously it's bringing them customers and Limbaugh listeners buy goods and services, purchase goods and services in the broader community, economic community. But, you know, again, you're judged by the company you keep. And, well, these companies are pulling back because they're feeling an economic pinch or economic blowback. The fact that they're sponsors in the first place, really troubling.
Yeah, you're right. Absolutely right.
I was wondering, with the pressure on unions nationwide, is the union here in Connecticut, are the unions here in Connecticut experiencing the same kind of squeeze we see in other states?
Absolutely. For me to say otherwise would be disingenuous. We are living in an era of in which unions have been scapegoated and Wall Street's been let off the hook. So we saw a slight increase actually in the overall union membership nationwide. Barely perceptible in terms of the overall growth numbers, but there was a net gain of about 49,000 union members, but that's nationwide. And
where are the jobs right now going? You see this job increase, but where are they?
In terms of union organizing, the job increase was driven mostly by gains in the private sector in retail industries, hotels, in some professional white-collar industries. The gain in private sector union members was actually offset by a steep decline in the number of public sector workers, and that's what's been going on in the economy, is that we've been seeing, and certainly we see it in Connecticut, through layoff and attrition, a diminishing number of state and local government workers, which is nothing to cheer. Again, these are we discussed this, I think, when I was on your show last month, that these are solid middle-class civil service jobs, and the corporations don't provide them. You know, government has always provided sort of this foothold into the middle class, women, people of color. When these jobs disappear, the negative ripples are felt throughout the entire, the broader middle class. So again, that's the trend, is that we're seeing very aggressive attacks on public sector workers as well as the private sector. It's very difficult to organize, and that's been one of the problems in this country.
Under Bush and the Homeland Security Department, these guys, government created 800,000 jobs under a Republican administration, federal jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That just blew me away. But when I found out what the jobs really were, was that they were repeating each other. They're, these guys are all over one another.
Mm-hmm.
Nine out of ten of those jobs are dealing directly with spying operations on people, the American people.
And, several years ago, probably when I first met you guys and came up to the Northwest Hills, we probably had this discussion when Bush pushed through, and the Republicans in Congress pushed through Homeland Security. Actually, that legislation explicitly denied hundreds of thousands of workers the right to bargain collectively. So that's an illusory kind of job gain. That legislation in a very, you know, Machiavellian evil way was designed to prevent workers from exercising their right to organize and live a better life. So we have to keep that in mind too when, you know, they tout the numbers of federal government employees. And, you know, because again, Homeland Security Act, I doubt was ever really about protecting the country. I think it was about giving, you know, corporations and giving the security companies, the Blackwaters and the contractors like Halliburton jobs, and keeping government workers from having the right to organize.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
But where do you see the trend now? Where do you see it going, Larry?
Difficult for me to predict. We're certainly out there. Our union is out there, both in the state and nationally. I think that where it's going, we've talked about this in the last few programs, if it's going to go positively, if we're going to improve the quality of work, if we're going to see better and stronger unions, I think it's going to be through some kind of coalition that sort of matches the Occupy folks with union folks, with community folks who are trying to, you know, the green jobs folks, people who are trying to make their communities better and do it in a way that's free of corporate extortion and the corporate strength. And I'm speaking obviously very broadly. We're pursuing a lot of policy initiatives. We want to see the minimum wage raised in Connecticut. We are pushing for a task force to look at providing retirement security to hundreds of thousands of workers who don't have it. So we're certainly trying to do our part in terms of pursuing sensible, helpful public policy objectives. But I think in a broader sense, Lila and Leo, if we don't really forge kind of real and lasting bonds with people outside the labor movement who are fighting for the same things we are, then I don't see a good future. But I do see a good future if we can somehow join hands and kind of march in that direction together.
Do you think that it would be more effective, the direction you were talking, is working in small towns and regions than trying to do so much nationally?
I do, in many ways, because I think that, you know, if we had a meeting, we had a forum, I should say, we had a couple of our AFSCME members participate in a forum at the Hartford Public Library, and it was young union workers, and by young I mean people under 35, and it was a panel discussion with Occupy Hartford. And I mentioned this, I believe, I talked a little bit about it last month, where, you know, 27-year-old man stood up and said, you know, I've been working kind of miserable service sector jobs because there's nothing out there, and I didn't think it, you know, that at 27, pushing, you know, almost 30, that this would be where I'm at. And, you know, we got to figure out a way to work together to create good jobs. So I do think we need to forge those bonds at the local level, at the community level, because that's where you can kind of teach people about unions, and that's where you can kind of demystify some of the incorrect things that are said about unions. And that's just as you can expose union members to the people who are fighting for, you know, green jobs and a better, you know, ways to match union workers with jobs that are going to reduce carbon footprints, that are going to make things more sustainable and make the economy more sustainable. So where it's at.
What did you think of the of what happened with General Motors, Chevy, where they just laid off, 2,600 workers because they stopped the production of the Volt?
Yes.
Yeah, that great Volt. Yeah. All right. I mean, I could never understand that car to begin with. I mean, $41,000 for an all electric car with no place to. I mean, where do you plug in?
I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I totally I'm not disagreeing, Leo. But at the same time, the three of us have had these conversations. We, you know, we need to break the stranglehold, you know, that big oil has. And I think that all intentions here were good to try and provide.
I think it was another boondoggle by the Obama administration when they came up with, you know, number one is they bailed out General Motors, gave them all kinds of dough.
Yep, no doubt about it. They did, but at the same time, those were, the jobs that were safe were a lot of good union jobs were safe as opposed to, the AIG executives and the Goldman Sachs and the Bear Stearns. Well, you know, that one went under, but you get
my point. What I'm saying, Larry, is that here again is the stupidity of the American car manufacturers, okay? Mm-hmm. The executives here. What in the hell were they thinking about when they knew they had a product? They overpriced this product, okay?
Right.
They overpriced it. They, the technology is not up there yet, okay?
Right.
No place to service these things. I mean, the Chevy dealers, yeah, but, I mean, there's no place to get a, I mean, where are you going to plug in? Your house? I mean, what if you have to commute 60 miles a day, you know?
It certainly didn't catch on the way the Prius did with the, you know,
with Toyota. Yeah, no, I, you know, but again, that I agree. It's just, you know, the tragedy here though is that good workers, good middle class people, are suffering for these failures, and we've got to figure out a way to keep these folks working and paying taxes and supporting their communities. Otherwise, we're going to be in trouble. We're trouble, and we're already in.
Available product, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
You know, and then maybe there would be there'd be long-term employment for everybody.
Right, and maybe part of the problem is that the frontline workers aren't listened to, and maybe we need to figure out a way to. Look, part of what we, when we had the difficulties with the Malloy administration last year, we've been pushing this whole idea of transforming government. And quite honestly, a big part of transforming government, and it ought to be this way in the private sector, we have too many managers. We have too many bureaucrats in our school systems, you know, setting up standardized tests and signing financial sheets and actually not teaching and instructing and helping kids.
Lots of data collection nowadays.
Yeah,
I don't know
and very little teaching.
Yeah, they have all this data. I don't know what they do with it all.
Right, and I think we need frontline workers like you. We need people who actually work with other people and educate them and provide a service. And if we had, and I think the same problem afflicts, in a worse way, corporate America because of the profit motive. You know, you've got these executives who are invested only in themselves and their shareholders, and, you know, they're not interested in actually having frontline collaborations with frontline workers. And I think that's, you got to compress and flatten out these bureaucracies to produce
innovation.
They feel
no responsibility toward the people that work for them.
No,
they feel there's no sort of ethics in business at all anymore.
Right.
You know, people used to feel responsible for the people that they employed. Part of being in business, of course, is making a profit. But also the other part is providing jobs for people, because that kind of what makes the world go round. If we're gainfully employed, we can earn money to lead better lives and have a more productive society. I mean, that's part of the whole package.
Well,
but people
think,
don't
equity as well. I mean, in Japan, the executives make 40 times the average wage. In the United States, executives make 450 times the average worker's wage. The splurge there is a little excessive.
Listen, I think that we have a deeply political problem in this country, because I think that political influence has gained civil society. You know, this is about the 1% wielding control over the 99%. And I think what you just said, the both of you, but Lyle in particular, is that I think you hit on it. But, you know, we need to restore the social contract, you know, where people get paid an honest day's wage for an honest day's work. People are treated respectfully. Senator Paul Wellstone has a wonderfully, the late Senator Paul Wellstone had this wonderfully simplistic quote, but I'm going to say it. And he said, "We all do better when we all do better." And think about that.
I think that's really true, and that's a wonderful quote. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, I love it, and I think it just captures the essence of what our problem is that, you know, we have this political problem in which, you know, I think that what ought to be a civil society has been usurped by that greedy 1%. And, you know, we had that Supreme Court decision that said corporations are people. So now we have money absolutely smothering democracy. We have a terrible industrial policy that actually rewards companies for having those factories overseas, where instead of dealing with workers who are frantic and fearful and committing suicide, you set up suicide nets to stop them. And, you know, that's the downward evolution or the devolution that the corporations are looking for. So, you know, we have a lot of these terrible trends and influences going on, and we've got to find a way to reverse them.
I wonder why Walmart has everything on one floor.
You know, I never thought of that.
The workers are on one floor.
And you know what? What really fries my you-know-what is when I was driving home today and I heard a Walmart ad on the radio where they said, you know, spend less, live better, you know, or save money. That's their slogan on their commercial, save money, live better. It ain't happening, not for the workers and not for the consumers who,
Walked around to Walmart. In fact, we were down there last week, and you got to go in there once in a while, you know, pick stuff up, but... The thing that amazes me is now they're coming out with all of the, they're turning it into supermarkets, you know, where half their stores are loaded with food.
Yep.
All of those foods, they signed an agreement with Monsanto, believe it or not.
Thank you, exactly.
All these genetically modified products, okay, and corn now is another thing. That they're planning to put Monsanto corn,
all genetically modified
corn, unlabeled
crap.
Of course, you know, in Walmart stores.
It's crap, you know.
Sure it is.
I mean, do you know because of Monsanto that corn is now listed as a pesticide?
That doesn't surprise me.
Corn is a pesticide, right? Because of the genetically modified strains, it has now
poison.
It produces its own pesticide. Okay, so this article, it's
not even a food.
It's listed by the
right. That's like the last thing it is.
Yeah, it's a pesticide. Corn. When did you think corn was a pesticide? You know,
never. And it shouldn't be that way.
It's really sick, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When you got this stuff rolling down on you, it's like, you know, I personally would like to boycott Walmart. I would like never to buy anything there.
I wish people would.
You know, and I've tried, like right now I'm trying to boycott Google. Try to boycott Google is rather difficult because of its privacy laws. You know, there are no privacy law, actually, that just came out. And, you know, I've closed down all my accounts and everything else with Google because, I mean, nothing is sacred anymore. You know, they'll sell everything you do, to their advertisers, you know.
But they're all like that.
And to the government, too, if they ask for it. And the less you do on Google, the better off you are. And, you know, that, anyway.
Very difficult.
Yeah, you can do anonymous takes with Google, but, you know, having your accounts with Google, having an account with them at Gmail or any of that stuff, it's all open to their.
You just read a month or so ago that they were going to, on Facebook,
Yeah, they posted, you know, on Facebook, Now, this article I saw, it looked legitimate. As of April 2nd, they were going to ask for social security numbers to log in.
I don't know whether that.
I don't even know how to. You know, that's just frightening.
Well, what are they going to do with it? What are they going to do with people?
Right. What are they going to do with that information?
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, they save everything forever if you're on there.
Yeah, they got this timeline thing. You're still on Facebook, aren't you?
I haven't been on it much lately, but I need to.
Get any posts from you, but I know. But they have they've got that timeline thing now. All right, that they were supposed to make it mandatory, but it became so many people were against it that they made it optional. I think, in fact, I think it was supposed to go into effect the first of this month, but it didn't. But the timeline, what that does is everything that you ever did or posted on Facebook will be on that.
Mm, interesting.
And accessible to the public, you know.
That's a lovely thought, isn't it?
You have the option to keep it private, to keep some of it private, but everything you ever said or did or
is there.
You know,
right.
So, like, you know.
I tell the kids this at school, actually. I said, you know, when you're 25, somebody or you or somebody else can read what you said when you were 13. So be very careful what you say.
Well, a good friend of mine just applied for a position, a job, and he deleted his entire Facebook account because
really?
He didn't want anybody look at it, you know?
Interesting.
You know, so he...
But anyway...
What's going on?
The state of the world, Larry. I want to thank you very much for being with us this evening.
We're solving it slowly. We solve it together. That's all.
I hope we do, and I'm going to remember Paul Wellstone's quote. I like that very much.
Good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're welcome,
you,
Larry.
Larry.
Talk to you soon.
Be well, Leo. Lila, take care.
Good night.
That was Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator of AFSCME Union, and now we're getting ready to have Woody in the ring. Let's play his music.
Thank you, Lila. Good evening, sports fans. Watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, the NFL, Bountygate, Mets bankruptcy issues, and a few other things going on in Major League Baseball. Well, let's get down to it. New Orleans general manager Mickey Loomis and coach Sean Payton met with investigators Thursday at the NFL's New York City headquarters to discuss former Saints defensive coordinator Greg Williams' pay-per-pain bounty program, according to two people familiar with the investigation. They are not authorized to speak publicly, however, while the action was ongoing. According to the Associated Press, the NFL met Monday with Williams, now the defensive coordinator for the St. Louis Rams. The league Friday released findings about the bounty program he administered from 2009-2011 that rewarded knockout hits and implicated Loomis and up to 27 players. Commissioner Roger Goodell is expected to mete out harsh punishment before the March 25th owners' meeting following blatant violations of the league's emphasis on player safety. Everything the NFL does is strategic, and the release of the information Friday is a preface to the punishment coming down sometime before March 25th. Agent Joe Linto, who represents 45 players, said Bountygate could exact harsher sanctions than the New England Patriots' 2007 Spygate scandal. Past coach Bill Belichick was fined $500,000, and the organization was docked a first-round pick and $250,000 for taping opponent signals. Anytime you have situations where players are purposely trying to inflict injury to affect players' careers, Linto said you have to deal with that in the most serious of manners. Now, anyone that's watched the NFL for a number of years, you may go back to, let's just say, the 80s. And there was guys on defensive squads writing down numbers of opposing players on the towel they would tuck in, into their pants. As I recall, Jim McMahon from Chicago Bears is on the hit list of the Green Bay Packers for quite some time. And he ended up really, they injured his shoulder. When he got hit, the guy picked him up off the ground and then kind of dunked him on his shoulder. And McMahon's career was kind of never the same after that. But, you know, the Bears, 46 defense, I mean, they did the same thing. And, I mean, this has been going on in the NFL for quite some time. And I think, you know, with all the new things that they're instituting to make sure players, you know, aren't, you know, physically unable years after retiring from the NFL or, you know, don't have these crazy head injuries, you know, which are just popping up years after, you know, because you get, you know, all kinds of, you know, blows to the head and so on and so forth. And I think the NFL would, you know, would be laughed at for these, you know, for these changes that they've made if they didn't probably act on this bounty stuff. As much as, you know, it's kind of cool, you know, you see the defense and, you know, they got a bounty and they want to knock this guy out of the game and all that other jazz. But, I mean, you know, there's more to life than football, and guys do have lives after football. And you would certainly hate to see someone's life affected because of a bounty. You know, maybe you get your career ended, you know, a short career because of this bounty thing that's going on and everything else. I mean, but it happens. And I think, you know, the NFL addressing this problem, I don't think it's going to go away, but I think maybe it'll lessen it. I don't know, but they definitely got to address it, and that's what they're doing. And believe me, if there's a rumor out that the punishments are going to be harsh, believe me, the punishments are going to be harsh. We're definitely talking draft picks and probably, you know, a shitload of money. Speaking of money, Major League Baseball officials are currently investigating ownership groups attempting to purchase the bankrupt Los Angeles Dodgers. Now have the growing reasons to be concerned that severe financial woes may force a sale of the New York Mets. The Mets were dealt a setback Monday when a federal judge refused to dismiss a $386 million lawsuit by the trustee seeking money for victims of Bernie Madoff's fraud case. U.S. District Court Judge Jed Rakoff said the trustee, Irving Picard, is entitled to collect as much as $83.3 million of fictitious profits from the Mets owners, even without trial. Youch. Rakoff said Picard can recover profits the Mets took out in the previous 2 years before Madoff's bankruptcy in December 2008. The ruling won't directly impact the day-to-day financial operations of the Mets, according to Raymond Seller, professor of economics at Clemson University, but it could force the Mets ownership to sell the franchise. According to Seller, a lot of sports owners get into it for the ego. When they become less wealthy, it can have a spillover effect on their team. Even if you have $100 million, you're going to be a lot poorer and question whether you want to be the primary source of revenue for a baseball team. Now, Mets owners Fred Wilpon and Saul Katz insist they have no knowledge that Madoff was conducting a $64.8 billion Ponzi scheme in their 25 years of business together. Madoff, 23, pleaded guilty to charges in 2009 and is serving a 150-year sentence in a North Carolina federal prison. We are preparing for trial, Sterling Partners, parent company of the Mets, said in a statement. We look forward to demonstrating that we were not willfully blind to the Madoff fraud. The Mets lost $70 million last year, according to the general manager, Sandy Alderson, and are finalizing a deal to sell $20 million minority stakes in the team to raise capital. Hedge fund executive Steve Cohen, one of the eight finalists to buy the Dodgers, purchased one of the 4% shares. The Mets plan to sell 10 to 12 shares. Things are not looking good for the Mets. The team pretty much blows. They're talking about getting rid of Wright. You know, he's one of the only few things they have left that they could probably trade that's worth anything. Nobody wants Santana. I mean, you know, the guy has a monster contract, and, you know, he has a history of injuries. And I think things are only going to get worse for the Mets. It's definitely something that's worth watching. But speaking of bad to worse, Lenny Dykstra, former Met and former Philadelphia outfielder, was sentenced to 3 years in the California State Prison in a grand theft auto case. Dice Shore was sentenced Monday after a Los Angeles County Superior Court refused to allow him to withdraw a no contest plea. Prosecutors say Dice Shore and two others tried to lease and then sell high-end cars from several auto dealerships by claiming credit through a phony business. Dice Shore also faces federal bankruptcy charges and is scheduled to stand trial this summer. He should be happy all he caught was 3 years. I did some reading on this about Dice Shore a few months ago, and you know, he was all whacked out on drugs and everything else and spending money like a madman. It's rather unfortunate. It's kind of weird, though. He put together this financial investment firm, and he put out there, like, this high-end magazine, and he tried to get it in all the locker rooms of all, you know, Major League Baseball, you know, NFL and stuff, and wanted to invest, you know, invested all kinds of guys' monies and stuff, and, you know, he lost all of it. I mean, he was riding high for a minute, but he ended up losing every dime, and then, you know, he did this big car scheme, you know, where they're trying to get cars on credit and stuff, and, you know, he finally got bagged, and, you know, it's too bad to see how the mighty have fallen. Also, another interesting thing I came across, ex-Red Sox employee accused of abuse. 9 more men came forward to say they were abused by a Boston Red Sox clubhouse manager who is now thankfully dead. The men, including 2 former Baltimore Orioles bat boys, are in addition to 2 former Red Sox clubhouse attendants who said in December they were abused by Donald Fitzpatrick, who died in 2005. Lawyer Mitchell Grady Monday said that the statute of limitations for legal action has expired, so the men are seeking, you know, of course, money, $5 million settlements from the Red Sox or Orioles. He's exploring possible legal action in 2 cases. Fitzpatrick pleaded guilty in Florida in 2002 to attempted sexual battery on a child under 12. Nice guy. The Red Sox settled a lawsuit with 7 Florida men claiming Fitzpatrick molested them. He resigned from the Red Sox in 1991, and yet that stuff still comes back to haunt them. Boy. All kinds of bad news tonight, you know? What are you going to do? That's just the way it is. So, you know. Anyway, I just want to go back to Dice Shore for a minute there. Yeah, it's just kind of strange. You know, he took all these classes, and he thought he was like this new whiz investment guy, and athletes just handed over all kinds of money to him. You know, you might be good on a baseball field or on a basketball court or out on the gridiron, but sometimes you're not too smart, and these guys just get preyed upon. Now, Dice Shore had good intentions, but a lot of athletes get preyed upon by hangers-on, phony investments, family, and so on and so forth. You know, and then they go through whatever league they're in, and you know, they're out of the league, and then years later they're bankrupt. And you know, it's just very sad. The number of guys that were in the NFL that are bankrupt within 5 years after leaving the NFL, it's just mind-boggling and very sad as well. But hopefully next week we'll have some better stuff going on. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there. Mark, Greg, Ron, everyone at the North Seaside Product Club, my partner, Money Mike. That's it for this week. Hopefully we'll get some sun next week.
Hey, thanks, Woody.
Check. Joe Arpaio says he suspects President Obama's birth certificate is a fake.
We believe. Probable cause exists indicating that forgery and fraud may have been committed.
Arpaio says his team of volunteer investigators believes President Obama's birth certificate is computer generated. They say they have a person of interest that may be involved in that hoax.
So what is next? CBS 5's Heather Moore has been trying to get... the answer to that question all night.
I've got a problem with this tape.
Hey, Heather, what did you come up with?
Well, Catherine and Cena, the sheriff says maybe Congress needs to take this on next. It all started up again when the Tea Party of Surprise asked your Sheriff Joe Arpaio to investigate. He, in turn, asked his volunteer cold case posse to dig in. Now, we spoke with the head of that team this afternoon who refused to talk to us about that so-called person of interest. However, he did say this may be the biggest scandal perpetrated on the American people, one of the biggest scandals perpetrated on the American people.
Oh, my God. Nobody wanted this. You know, nobody wants to think this is happening, you know, in their country.
Lead investigator Michael Zullo claims the group didn't set out to take down the president.
Our goal in the beginning was to prove this document authentic. The problem is the evidence has taken us somewhere else.
He says it took 6 months and 2,200 hours to come to the conclusion that President Obama's birth certificate from Hawaii, released by the White House last April, was manufactured.
Never was a paper document. It was literally created in the mind of a computer and resides on cyberspace.
The White House responded today by pointing to the president's comments last year regarding the same issue.
We're not going to be able to solve our problems if we get distracted by sideshows and carnivals.
This is your face, your reputation, your name in the front of this investigation. How comfortable are you making these allegations?
I'm very comfortable because we did seek the advice of experts regarding this. You can build the document. We can take the document apart out of the same file released by the White House. You can't do that if you just scan in a birth certificate or any other document.
What do you say to the naysayers? And there are a lot of critics out there saying this is all, you know, a bunch of BS.
Prove it. We did. We proved our point. That document's created.
And from here, Sheriff Arpaio may look for a congressional investigation. We reached out to...
Sorry about the interruptions here, but...
every member of Arizona's congressional delegation in...
I don't know what's causing that.
Washington today. Only Representative Jeff Flake's office got back to us saying that he believes that President Barack Obama... is a U.S. citizen and was born here in the United States. Reporting live in Phoenix, I'm Heather Moore, CBS 5 News.
Heather, thank you. So, how did they reach that conclusion? Here's more now from Investigator Zullo at today's press conference.
I don't understand how they proved this.
Mr. Obama's birth certificate, there are approximately 8 or 9 links and layers. Links and layers are indicative of a document being built.
The birth certificate was... compared to a controlled document that investigators scan into a computer. After close examination, Zulu said there were several inconsistencies. Between the two. One had to do with the so-called green safety paper. Investigators say it should be seen on the onset of the birth certificate, but they determined it was the last element applied to the document. Zulu also claims the register and date stamps can be moved around. He says if the document was authentic, you wouldn't be able to do that.
Whoever created this document imported that register stamp and that date stamp, laid it on a white background.
Well, then they didn't do a good job.
And then filled in the green safety paper around it.
Zulu tells us Obama's birth certificate failed every test they put it through. All six videos explaining the steps of the investigation were uploaded to YouTube by the user Tea Party Power Hour.
CBS 5 viewers are speaking their minds on this one. Penny wrote, "What the heck is going on with this state? We have a disrespectful governor and a sheriff that is going rogue. Has everyone in power in Arizona lost their ever-loving minds? For Pete's sake, we have a lot bigger problems than this." Margie says the birth certificate should be had been presented before Obama ever ran for president. Why wasn't it? He is undermining our country in a multitude of ways that the media refuses to expose. I wish I could trust our president, just can't. Susan chimed in, "It's costing us nothing to invest Obama. I think he's a fraud. Did it?
That's too bad.
Occur to anyone that Obama is pushing amnesty so hard because he's illegal. I say more power to Sheriff Arpaio." Well, this story is just beginning to unfold. Stay with CBS 5 News for the most in-depth coverage on Arpaio's investigation into.
That was in Arizona. So, and that's an Arizona station. But I think it's
interesting. I hope folks got the gist of that. It was very annoying to try to listen to
God,
it. I'm so sorry.
But important. You can go to it on YouTube. Just check out Investigating the President, Channel 5 News. This last one is, I don't know if it was the last one, but close to the last article we read tonight. Documents reveal Rockefeller Foundation actively engaged in mass mind control.
Let's go to that full article.
I think that was a pretty good, pretty good read.
Probably through TV.
Well, no, they started it. They started it through everything. I mean, you know, study groups and all kinds of stuff.
Hmm.
So, and big grants to scientists.
From archive material from the 1940s onward, it's become apparent that the Rockefeller Foundation has, for decades, now fanatically nurtured research into fear-inducing brainwashing techniques for the masses. In a series of generous grants in the 1940s and 50s extended to Professor Carl A. Hovland of Yale University, the foundation actively funded research into the psychological mechanisms through which communications exert their influence. Main research subjects deals with the question of how the individual deals with the welter of conflicting ideas with which he is constantly bombarded, how wishful thinking and emotional bias affect judgment, and whether the judgment process is transferred from one situation to another among the problems to be studied. We read in the 1954 Rockefeller Yearly Report. Hovland, besides conducting research into behavioral and attitude changes of groups, was also part of the Rockefeller Foundation social science staff. In addition to that, the professor was heavily involved in other branches of Anglo-American establishment in the study Origins of Mass Communication Research During the American Cold War by Timothy Glander, the author explains. Hovland held key positions on several major national boards, including the Air Force Human Resources Research Institute, the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Office of Chief of Staff of the U.S. Air Force, and he doubtlessly had input into determining the research agendas that these organizations pursued. Already in 1948, the foundation was directing cash toward Hovland and his team. In the 1948 report, the authors outlined the reasons behind the grants given. An understanding of communication and attitude change is important to our educational system, to those who lead great organizations, and to those who are concerned with the political opinion and behavior. More dependable knowledge of how effective communication may be achieved in the area of attitude and opinion is essential. In the days of the Cold War, the propaganda was often so blatantly obvious to the accustomed to freedom Westerner that it was more easily identifiable as such. The Rockefeller Foundation understood that the American people needed to be subjected to more sophisticated forms of manipulation if the gradual push for global government was to be effectively sold in the decades to come, the 1954 report explains.
Although movies, television, and comic books are widely believed to be effective in contributing to the rise in juvenile delinquency in this country, these and the other media of mass communication appear to be much less effective when applied to the desirable end of promoting good citizenship or a positive democratic ideology in the Cold War. Good citizenship, a phrase that should chill the very fiber of every freedom-loving individual. It is feared that the Soviet mass communications are outstandingly successful in disseminating communist propaganda, both behind the Iron Curtain and in neutral countries. In an effort to throw light on this anomaly and to aid development of scientific principles governing the effectiveness of mass media, the Rockefeller Foundation has continued its support of the communications research program at Yale University with an outright grant of $200,000. That was a quote by the member there of the group. The report, the 54 report. In 1954, $200,000 was an exceptional amount of money. This substantial grant is just one example out of many in which Rockefeller Foundation threw huge sums of cash in the direction of social scientists for refining and perfecting the art of indoctrination. One of the results of their studies was that fear induced otherwise makes a person a willing victim for the elite. The website changeminds.org gives an adequate summing up of Professor Hovland's findings.
You do not have to cause pain to create fear. The human frontal The human frontal cortex has a primary function in thinking about the future. We are quite skilled at imagining what might happen and experiencing anticipatory emotions. This has proved helpful in our evolution, but it also causes problems as anticipated fear of things that may not happen can cause us stress and allow others to persuade us. The study phase has long since evolved in the implementation phase. In the mid-70s, the foundation was already busy buying off reporters and funding media empires into existence. Even then, climate change was actively being promoted as a tragic result of human meddling in the affairs of Mother Earth. Genetically engineered food was already being pushed as the cure to remedy all ills. The thing was putting the emotion-based response as observed by Hovland into practice. The 1974 Rockefeller Journal reports, several science editors were asked to participate in foundation meetings on climate change, food production, and interstate conflict, genetic resistance in plants to pests, and aquaculture. Stories appeared subsequently on the front page of the New York Times and the Associated Press, carried substantial stories which were widely used. In each instance, the writers were introduced to our program officers and encouraged to use them as resource people. Offices are now, in fact, being called on by journalists, particularly in the area of current high news interests, such as food production, population problems, environmental issues, and the arts.
On several occasions, and different publications, writes, throughout its long and sordid past, the Rockefeller Foundation openly brags using media figureheads for their own purposes. In none of these instances does the RF mention any problem encountered with any of the media moguls they contacted. In the 1974 yearly report, Bill Moyers is mentioned as one of the beneficiaries of information decimated disseminated by the foundation. And I want to complete this article, but we're just about out of time.
Yeah.
And we'll just read it ongoing. But I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. And please join us tomorrow night when we have Tex Mars. Again, a 45-minute interview with Tex, author of Conspiracy World, and his new DVD is the
Die,
America Die. And we'll be talking to him tomorrow night. But let me, if you don't mind, let me just see. This article is almost done. There's only two more paragraphs.
Yeah, okay.
All right, so I just wanted to say, I forgot where I was.
Right here.
Several science editors foundation. Bill Moyers, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so Bill Moyers was a big disseminator of foundation material. Still is, I'm sure, because he's still doing his program.
In preparing its remarkable 25-part series on the world food situation, the New York Times reporters have been acquainted and have established fruitful ongoing relationships with a good many of our offices. Our staff have provided substantial information and further contacts for Bill Moyers in his television series dealing with the problems of global interdependence. There are only a few of the many productive new relationships we have established with representatives of the mass media.
In order to sell the public on world government, the research of Professor Howland has proven invaluable. As anyone can see, the techniques are fanatically being applied to this day. And consider the warmongering machine the Anglo-American establishment fires up as soon as geopolitical objectives come into view. In part two of this investigation, we will delve into another dimension of Professor Hovland's research, which lies at the core of all mass communications, the influence of film and music on the subconscious mind, directed both at the individual and at the masses.
Mm.
So this is an ongoing report. And you can see this on Infowars.com, all right? And fascinating. And we know that we're being mind-controlled.
Yeah.
All right? And we
God
know...
God knows what else they
we're
develop
being
there.
So manipulated.
Horrible poisons and vaccines
and
all kinds of things.
We know we're being manipulated, folks, and you know that, too, because you're listening to this program. But we want to thank Larry Dorman for being on our show tonight.
And we want to thank Witty in the ring.
And if you want to check more out with the Ask Me Union, especially Larry writes the newsletter and for them, and he's the public affairs coordinator. But you can go to council4.org, council4.org. That's council4 with the 4 instead of F-O-R, but council4.org, and check out his site. It's a great site. I'll give you a lot of update news and everything else. Thank you for listening.
Yep, and
again, join us tomorrow night. Lila and I and Tex Mars will be here.
Yeah, we're looking forward to continuing our conversation with him.
And Tex,
so, good night, folks.
Tex is the host of Prophecy Hour. Power of Prophecy, rather. And also author of about 20 books. And he's
a
fascinating guy. We'll have him for you tomorrow night. So I want to thank everybody for joining us, and we wish you...